have better health care in this country because a black man pushed through health care reform in the federal government. So ultimately, I think that that's the way to maximize the support and reduce some of the opposition is by showing that. And even if you look historically, right, it wasn't that Rosa Parks wanted to desegregate the buses just so black people could ride. She wanted to desegregate the buses so public transportation would be accessible to everybody. And that is the ultimate goal and objective. And as we advance that mission, there really is really little basis for opposition to it, which is partly why they do so much distorting around what the actual agenda is.
And we've seen life expectancy rates in this country falling. There's been some analysis showing that the places where they're falling, because it's not geographically even, the places where they're falling are the places where Republican-led state-level policies have curtailed access to health care, have
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282. BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Calling all denizens of Earth. Tune in to KBOO on Saturday, April 22nd from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. for KBOO's Earth Day Takeover. It's a whole day of radio programming devoted to climate action and environmental justice. Join us and prepare for nature sounds, music, and activist interviews focused on our shared climate future. That's KBOO's Earth Day Takeover on Saturday, April 22nd from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. and online at kboo.fm/earthday.
Welcome to another episode of Civic Cypher. I am your host, Ramses Ja.
He is Ramses Ja. I am Q Ward. I see I got my voice back. I was starting to like the quiet storm, Ramses. You know, but I'm back to being Q now, and you guys are tuned in to Civic Cypher.
Yeah, we need that, man. Q back in the land of the living, sounding good. And that's a good thing because we got a whole lot to bring you this week. Of course, crazy stories all across the news, not the least of which is Ralph Yarrell. And the emotional roller coaster that's been. For those that don't know, please stay tuned because we will educate you on all the goings on with that story. And if we're honest, that story got us to thinking about the amount of anti-black violence that we have to deal with in this country and what it's like to live in the aftermath of that. A lot of times we talk about stories that are very final in that it often results in death. So today we're going to talk about what it's like to live in the aftermath of anti-black violence for those that do survive. And we have a story from our own backyard. We're joined in the studio by Marshawn Neely. So welcome to the studio, brother.
Yes, thank you. I'm honored to be here.
Absolutely. So he's got a crazy story to tell us. And the story does have a happy ending in that you're still here with us and you're actually fighting back. So we can't wait to peel back the layers of that. You're in the middle of a lawsuit at this as well, right?
Yes.
Okay. So definitely a lot to stick around for there. We're also going to be talking about, for the Way Black History Fact, the origins or the black origins in hockey. And, you know, that's something that I didn't know about. And I'm really excited to share that with you because I thought that black people didn't start playing hockey until the 80s maybe, but actually goes a lot deeper than that. So stay tuned for that and so much more. But first and foremost, it's time for some Ebony Excellence. So Q, I think this one is for you.
You know, I was thinking about the Ebony Excellence for this week. To say I got a little bit emotional when I read about the subject of our Ebony Excellence would be putting it lightly. But this week's Ebony Excellence is brought to you by Ramses's Afro. Okay, if you've never seen this thing, it is glorious. There's the reason why a lot of us smile. It's like sunshine. But I'll talk to you guys a little bit more about that later. The story comes from CBS Sports. Bills safety DeMar Hamlin announces his plan to return to the NFL after what a lot of us saw as a very, very scary on-field collapse. And what can only be described as a remarkable recovery, DeMar has been fully cleared to return to football activities. Man. Whew, I had to take a deep breath reading that because I saw this incident live when it happened. Quote, I'm thankful and blessed, Hamlin said at a press conference Tuesday end quote. Blessed to have wonderful trainers here who treat me with love and care as if I was one of their own children. This event was life-changing, but it's not the end of my story. I'm here to announce that I plan on making a comeback to the NFL. The diagnosis of what happened to me was basically commotio cordis. It's a direct blow at a specific point in your heartbeat that causes cardiac arrest. And 5 seconds later, you fall out. That's what everyone has seen back on January 2nd of this year. All of us that seen it, I can say that we were terrified in the moment. He's been cleared for football activities. I'm hoping his brother makes a recovery and that he does not find himself in any life-threatening positions as a result of that. Prayers up for DeMar Hamlin.
I think that's Ebony Excellence if we've ever seen it. That's resilience right there.
Talk to me about it.
I love that. All right. So, living in the aftermath of anti-Black violence. As I mentioned, our guest today is Marshawn Neely. And, you know, let's not keep folks waiting. Why don't you tell us the story of what happened to you, your most recent encounter with the police?
It just started off as a normal day. Then it just went all downhill from there. Me and my girlfriend, we got into a simple argument that day. She wanted me to leave. You know, I was getting ready to leave anyway, just to defuse the situation. Mm-hmm. I think her mother had suggested to her to call the police that way nothing happens, you know, any fighting or anything. Mm-hmm. But like I do, I want to let you guys know I don't condone domestic violence or, you know, women hitting men or men hitting women. It was just, you know, a simple argument that happened that day, and the police were called to my house. And when the police arrived, they actually already opened my door to my house. It was unlocked and I didn't know. So in the video, you could see me coming around the corner. The door is ajar. I instantly closed the door. I let them know that were okay, because they actually came later. It took them a while to come. So by that time, we already defused the situation. We talked it out. She wanted them to leave, and I shut the door. The next thing you know, they bust down my door. And when they bust down the door, in the video, you could see me like ball up, because I thought that they were just going to grab my hand and turn me around and just, you know, detain me or ask me what happened. Because at this point in time, whenever the police are called, you're still innocent until proven guilty. So, you know, I didn't feel like any crimes was committed. I never hit anyone. I never touched anyone. So I thought they were going to talk to me. You know, normally if someone is called, they just ask one of the parties to leave until things die down. Instead, I think by me being Black, they just wanted to take it there. So they didn't like the fact that I shut the door to my own house. My lawyer, Kwesi Smith, he's a retired police officer, and he basically told me like that was a bad idea to shut the door because they're still going to investigate. So they broke the door down, and from there, the first police officer, instead of grabbing my arm and putting it behind my back, because that's normally how you get arrested, they take your arms and put them in handcuffs. Instead of him doing that, he actually took my head and like slammed it into the wall. He slammed it into the wall. I wound up losing 4 teeth automatically. I got 2 of them fixed. That was almost like $3,000. And then I still got to get the other 2 fixed. I'm working on that now, but he slammed my head into the wall. I lost 4 teeth. They take me to the ground. Now, when they take me to the ground, there's 3 officers on me, and one officer has his arm across my like nose and face, so I can't breathe at that time.
This is still in the like doorway of your house?
Yeah. Okay. I had the video footage and I released that. So at this time, I'm letting the police know, like, in the video that they released on the news, they actually muted every word out that I said. Like, when they took me to the ground, I'm letting them know I'm not resisting. I'm not resisting. I can't breathe because at that time, he's like basically holding my nose and my mouth because he got his arm across me and we got like three officers with their knees in my back. So, man, you at this time, when they take me to the ground, they break four of my teeth. So I'm not trying to escalate the situation anymore. I feel my teeth like falling out my mouth. I'm like, hey, my hands are behind my back. So the next thing they do, an officer reaches and grabs my hand, and that's when he snaps my finger in half. He broke my bone to my finger, and he broke my knuckle. So,
and this is what I'm seeing right here on your finger.
Yeah, so when you break a bone can be fixed, but my knuckle cannot be fixed. I had needles in my hand, so like half of my knuckle was sitting right here. The other half is sitting right here. This finger, I can't bend at all. It's permanently going to be like this for the rest of my life. I can't use this finger. I can't write all day long. I'm massaging it. So when he reached down to put on me in handcuffs, they break my four teeth. They slam me into the wall. They slam my head. They break four teeth now and grabbing my hand. The officer snaps my finger. I feel it. I yell. Now, the way they had me on the ground, I'm laying like at an angle. So half of my body is sticking out my laundry room. My legs are inside the laundry room.
Your laundry room is by the front door?
Yeah, it's by the front door.
Okay.
So half of my legs are inside the laundry room door. And that's when they bring the K-9 in. I'm not running. I'm not resisting. And at this point, the K-9 handler, he yells at the police officer, give me a leg. And the police officer, instead of him helping the other two finish putting me in handcuffs so they can get off of my back and stop me, because I'm almost finna pass out. I'm like, it's like I'm finna die. Like, I really felt what George Floyd felt that day when they put knees in his back. I just thought I was gonna die because I can't breathe. So instead of him helping the police, the officer gets off of my back and he's really holding down my legs.
Real quick. I want to paint a picture for folks that are listening to the story. So how tall are you? How much you weigh?
I'm like 140. I'm probably like 5'5". I'm a little guy.
Okay. All right. Keep going.
Okay. And these officers are huge. Okay. Huge.
That's what I wanted to establish.
Huge.
Go ahead. Keep telling.
So once he gets off of my leg, I have to straighten my body up because I'm at an angle. But my legs automatically like straighten out and they go down. And that's when the officer releases the dog on my leg, and the dog actually bit my leg for almost a minute. They couldn't get him off. He bit my leg for a minute. And then that's when I'm like telling them, like, get the dog. I'm screaming, get the dog. And at the time it is, you know, I got kids in the house, man. So my kids still ask me to this day, like, is anybody going to come in the house and hurt dad, or what's going on with dad? Like, my kids still remember me screaming, you know, the stuff that went on that day.
How long ago was this? Did this happen?
This happened in November.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So.
And you've been dealing with this ever since, I'm sure.
Ever since.
Okay. So keep going.
So after they yanked me up off the floor, I can't walk. So they're basically like dragging me out the house. So they cut the video. They edited the video where they take my what words out while I'm telling them.
First off, how long did it take for you to get that video from? Which police department was this?
Goodyear Police
in
Arizona.
Arizona. Okay. How long did it take for you to get that video?
Took them almost 4 months. Almost four months.
And then they released an edited version of the video.
Okay. Where literally my words are muted. You don't hear me say I can't breathe. You don't hear me say I'm not resisting. You don't hear me say any of that.
Okay. I seen the video, so I know.
So they edited that out. And what they edited too is like, they didn't show like how my neighbors were concerned. They were outside praying for me and stuff like that. So once they bring me out the house, they like sit me on the curb and I'm just leaking blood everywhere. Leaking blood.
Can I see where the dog bit you?
Oh yeah, of course.
Just so I could see.
Okay, this is where they stitched it up. The dog bit me here. And the main part was that kept me from walking for months is
when he bit the back of my calf muscle, I'm laying down on the ground.
Get a little closer. So explain that again, the back of your...
Yeah, so when he bit the back of my calf muscle, they weren't able to stitch this up or do anything to it. It just had to heal naturally.
Okay.
And that took months. And it still hurts to this day. I have trouble walking. I could barely can walk. I could stand up straight. It's horrible. So...
Let me ask you this. Did the dog bite and then shake?
Yeah, shake and lock. Okay. He locked to my leg. Now, mind you, I done been in a fight before, but I never had a broken bone. I never had anyone knock four of my teeth out, and I never had a dog maul my leg off. So, you know, I didn't know about surgeries at this time. I went through several surgeries, but when the ambulance finally came, they took me to the hospital. Then the officer was joking with me like, oh, you never played rugby before. People get their teeth knocked out every day. Like it was a normal thing for me to be missing four teeth, for my finger to be broken. So they take me to the first hospital. And at the first hospital, when you're in police custody, they don't let you use telephones to contact your family members to let them know what's going on, because they feel like by me being charged with a misdemeanor, I could break out of jail and have somebody come to the hospital to free me.
Wait a minute. You said this was a misdemeanor?
Yeah, all this is a misdemeanor charge.
Okay, and did these officers fear for their life? Did they get the sense that you were trying to run or escape or anything like that?
In the 911 call, it was actually stated that I had no weapons and I did not hit anyone. So I don't know why they took it that far.
Okay. All right. Keep going. So you can't call anyone from the hospital.
So when I get to the hospital, it's a big ordeal about the cops, because the police, they have to sit with you inside the hospital. So it's a big ordeal about, hey, we're switching shifts now. One is ready to go home. So they're talking to me about surgery now. So I'm scared. They're like, oh, we got to stick you with needles. We got to put you to sleep. I'm going to have to open you up. I'm like, let me call some of my family members and let them know what's going on. Mm-hmm. So they refused me a phone call at the hospital. And they just say, like, I never signed the papers. So you got to sign a paper saying that you refuse service. I never signed the papers. So they instantly just yanked me out the hospital bed, dragged me back to the car. Then they take me to jail. So now I'm at the jail. The jail was completely wrong from even accepting me into jail, because the CEOs let them meet me. No, you can't accept no one into jail with broken bones and just leaking blood. So they went against protocol. They let me go to the Maricopa County Jail with a broken finger, broken teeth, my leg leaking. So they basically just throw me in a cell for about 10 hours, and I'm ringing the bell constantly. But I don't want to put too much blame on the Maricopa County Jail, because I feel like I shouldn't even been there to begin with. Like, I feel like I should have just been left at the hospital till I needed the proper care, till I could digest what's going on. Like, I'm still thinking it's a movie. Like, I can't believe, like, what's happening. So they take me to the cell. They leave me in the cell for almost 10 hours. I probably got to jail at like 9 in the morning. I didn't make it to the hospital till midnight that night. So I'm in the cell just all day, leaking blood, pressing the bell. Hey, I need help. I need some type of antibiotic. I don't want to catch an infection or anything like that. I don't know if this dog has rabies, anything like that. So they leave me in the cell all day, 12, 16 hours. Finally, a black CEO that works for the jail, I don't remember his name, he just tells me, like, man, that's messed up. They weren't supposed to take you into jail. They weren't supposed to leave us with this job to bring you to go get care. Like, it was just, they really felt bad for me. So that's why I don't want to put the blame on them too much, because they did show their sympathy. Like, man, that's messed up. They shouldn't have brought you here. They should have took full responsibility. So now I'm in Valley Wise Hospital. That's the county jail for Phoenix. I'm in there in the middle of the night. You got it. Now you think, when I get to the hospital again, it's 1 o'clock in the morning. There's nobody there to perform surgery. They basically just wrap me up and sit me in the hallway to the morning. Now it's probably like 5, 6 in the morning. That's when all the doctors get to work. Now they perform a surgery later that afternoon. They perform the surgery. I wake up, I got needles sticking out my hand.
From your finger being broken?
Yes, I got needles sticking out my hand. I got stitches in my leg. I'm wrapped up. And I literally...
Are your teeth still missing at this time?
I'm missing two still right now. I got two of them fixed.
No, I mean while you're in the hospital.
Oh, yeah, I'm missing teeth. Yeah. Okay. No dentist. And that's another thing. My teeth became infected because once you get a chipped tooth or open tooth, you got to have a root canal and they have to pull out the nerve. So my teeth became infected. So now I'm out of surgery. It's probably like a day later. The sergeant for the jail hospital, he comes to the room and they just get to snatching stuff out of my arm. I'm hey, what's going on? He say, you gotta go. I say, what do you mean I gotta leave? I'm still in pain. Like, I'm trying to make sure everything is okay. You know, they literally kicked me out probably 24 hours after I had my surgery. So they kicked me out the hospital. They're like, you're not finna stay here. So they kicked me out. They take me back to jail. Now, I'm not in a regular population where I could get assistance or anything like that. This is the worst experience ever. I'm in a cell for 24 hours a day by myself. Like, I don't got a phone. I don't got a TV. I don't got a tablet. I don't got anything. I'm just in a cell by myself because it's an infirmary cell. So they don't want you to get hurt by another inmate. So they'll keep you in a cell by yourself. So I was on a lockdown for 24 hours for almost 2 weeks until they came with a plea deal for me to get out of jail.
And this was a misdemeanor, you said?
Yeah, a misdemeanor.
And what was the charge?
They charged me with a lot of stuff like resisting arrest, disorderly conduct,
trumped up charges.
Yeah,
would call that.
Yeah. But they basically dropped all the charges and just charged me with a domestic violence or interfering with court procedures. And then they just said, hey, take this plea. We'll let you out of jail. And you don't got to serve any jail time or anything like that.
Okay. So now you're actually pushing back, right? So you said you got a lawyer and you're taking legal action because this was a gross abuse of power by the Goodyear Police Department.
Yes.
And so tell us a little bit about that.
The lawsuit?
Yeah.
Oh,
you don't have to tell anything.
Yeah.
Your lawyer wouldn't want you to say,
but yeah,
let the people know this has a happy ending.
When I got out of jail, I basically called a few lawyers. I'm not going to say it was kind of hard to get the case started, but, you know, a lot of people probably didn't want to take the case on for free. Well, I found Quasi Smith. He's actually an African-American lawyer, and he decided to take the case on for free by him being a ex-police officer. He knows, like, how far this should go and when is enough. So he took the case on, and after that, we filed a notice to claim. So to let them know that we'll be suing them. But I just want to let you guys know, it's not about the money. It's about the accountability. Like, I literally had situations where people came to me after this said, hey, I should have stepped up and did the same thing, but I was scared about the outcome. Like, I had people that had similar scenarios happen that never went this far as suing the police or making them take accountability for what they did.
Let me ask
what
you
they
this.
Did.
How have you been? I mean, I've seen physically, you know, you're doing better than you were, I'm sure. But how have you been mentally since this has all happened?
Horrible, horrible, horrible. Like, I think the police is going to kick my door in. I don't feel safe in my own home. I'm scared of dogs now. Like, Arizona, everybody has dogs. So I can't go to the, I actually have a little dog. Oh, I see.
You asked when you came in the studio, is there a dog here?
Yeah. So I'm actually scared of dogs right now because it's just crazy.
Well, that's a lot to process. Q, you want to jump in or
typically I do want to jump in. Today, however, is not typical. Because I'm usually just flatly enraged by stories like this. Except this time I'm sitting here listening to a firsthand account from a brother who is quite frankly far more calm than I could possibly be if I was retelling this experience. The idea that our skin is criminal.
It's hard to imagine it happening to someone else, yeah. Someone not black.
No. See that, and that, I don't want to be colorful with my language. It's not hard to imagine that because we have no such stories.
Yeah, we talked about before.
We have none. Like, you have to understand that the climate of our country right now, there are people who spend their entire days looking to debunk the myth of racism, looking to debunk the idea that police target us unfairly because we're black. Trust me, if there were any such stories,
they would have found.
They'd be all over the place, yeah, all the time, right? The poor young man who, you know, we're raising money for, who we're talking about later on today, is already people counter producing stories to counter his story. Well, something happened to this white girl and you guys didn't raise that much money for her. It's like, even in stories where we are by far the victim, they don't want there to be a happy ending. They don't want us to feel any relief. You know, and it's a sad thing that our country has now sunk to a place where we're so divisive in our politics that we are now divisive in our humanity.
You know, there's something about this story too, before we move on, that is kind of redundant and commonplace because we've seen this a lot. In fact, we talked about a story, Jeffrey Ryan's in Salt Lake City, who was kneeling, had his hands up, and the police sicked the dogs on him. And when I was trying to find out his name, so many of those attack dog stories came up. In fact, you sent over a video from Inside Edition, and the title was, "Are Police Dogs Being Ordered to Bite Suspects Unnecessarily?" So we appreciate your story, and obviously this is something we'll keep tabs on moving forward.
And now,
Proper propaganda.
Watch it. Pull my mic back. You like that? Journalists with journalists too. We can strike back. Hardcore reporters with orders from headquarters. Behind enemy lines, sidestepping the borders.
For those just tuning in to Civic Cypher, I'm your host, Ramses Ja.
He is Ramses Ja. This is a very emotionally and mentally exhausted Q War. If you caught the first half of the show, you have an idea why. If you didn't, keep listening. We always, unfortunately, have enough to keep me feeling like this.
It'll get better.
And that's what my brother says to me every week.
It will. Today, we're talking about living in the aftermath of anti-Black violence. Special guest in the studio, Marshawn Neely, who just shared a bit of his personal story where he was a victim of police brutality, let's be honest, and specifically a victim of a police attack dog. And we're going to spend the second part of the show talking about Ralph Jarl, and we'd love for you to stick around and share your thoughts as well. But first and foremost, let's discuss becoming a better ally, Baba. So today's Baba is sponsored by Major Threads for the finest in men's sportswear. Check majorthreads.com. You know, sometimes with the Baba, we help with big things in a little way, and sometimes we help with little things, but in a big way. And this past week, we came across a story from a young lady named Jamiya Bratcher. I'm not sure how to say it, but just one of those stories that kind of hit me in the heart. She's an individual who was sent to a homeless shelter, dropped off at a homeless shelter on her 18th birthday and told to make her way.
Can you let our audience know who dropped her off?
It was her adopted parents that dropped her off at a homeless shelter because they were no longer receiving money for her. She made a video about it. Someone was interviewing folks on the street, and that video touched me and the people around me. And normally now's the time I'd list her Cash App, because she showed her Cash App on the screen if someone wanted to help. But she said she didn't know how to work it. And I'll be honest, I sent money and it never got accepted. So I really wanted to talk about her, supporting her financially. But now I'm going to ask, since we have stations all over the country, she's gone missing. And I would like for you all to please travel over to my Instagram at Ramses Ja, R-A-M-S-E-S-J-A. She's the first photo there. And if you've seen her anywhere, you got any information on her, please, you know, contact me or contact anybody that's connected to that, because we need to find her and make sure that she's okay. Again, we can help a lot in a small way, and this is just on my heart. So I appreciate you, anybody supporting that. All right, now we're going to move on. We're still talking about living in the aftermath of anti-Black violence, but another crazy story that has kind of really taken shape over the past week is the story of Ralph Jarl, who was shot by Andrew Lester for knocking on the wrong door when he was looking to pick up his siblings. I think he went to the right number address, but instead of street, it was lane, or lane, it was street, or something like that. So he ended up at the
some easily mistakable minor semantic like that.
Yeah. And he rang the doorbell, and I'll read from the Kansas City Defender, who's a big supporter of Civic Cypher. Shout out to the Kansas City Defender. Ralph Jarl, a 16-year-old Black boy, was shot twice by a white man in North Kansas City after accidentally ringing the doorbell of the wrong home while attempting to pick up his siblings. My understanding was his two little brothers. Mm-hmm. The white man reportedly shot Ralph in the head and shot through the glass door. And when Jarl was already bleeding on the ground, he shot him again, this time in the head. The family has described it as a hate crime, and community members are calling for justice for the young victim.
And just so we're clear around this, the first shot was in the head.
Was it? Okay.
Yeah. So imagine
I read that wrong.
No, you read it right, but then you just added that this time it was in the head after you read about the second shot. You shot him in the head already.
Through the door, yeah. Okay.
Like, for all of us to pause, he shot him in the head already.
Yeah.
Then let me go make sure and shoot him again.
And he was unarmed?
16.
He was an unarmed child. Yes, sir.
I'm just making sure.
Oh, yeah. No, sure. So one of the things that I want to say here is sad and sick. And we've talked about it on the show before, Q and I. There was an audio recording that we came across some months ago of a police person, someone with some authority over normal police officers, suggesting that if an officer draws a gun and shoots someone, that they should make sure that the person dies, because if the officer shoots someone and they live, they could sue, and fiscally that would have a greater impact than if the person was actually dead.
Now there's a victim statement.
Yeah.
That would never happen before if the person was dead. And that's where that lack of accountability typically comes in.
Right.
There's no victim statement.
There's no other witness. Marshawn Neely in the studio with us telling his side of the story.
Yes.
So this idea of the second shot when he's already been shot in the head, as you said, I don't know for certain, but I suspect that might have played a role in it, because again, a shot in the head through the door.
Yeah, we have to avoid definitives.
Yeah, it's tough because, you know, these are ongoing
to maintain our integrity as journalists in this space. It is not, however, lost on me the reason you shoot this kid again.
Yeah.
If it was fear or defending for your life, you already shot him in the head. I think you'll be fine, especially because he's a child with no weapon and no way to harm you.
Mm.
I think you'd be fine.
Yeah.
We know what the second shot was for.
Oh, yeah. And you mentioned something in the first half of the show, Q, that I want to bring back up. The only quote-unquote weapon was that he had melanin in his skin.
Yes, too much.
That's the only weapon. And as you know, I mean, I'm obviously being facetious here, but that's not a weapon. That is a human condition. Human beings have melanin. Original human beings, Homo sapiens sapiens, were melanated individuals from Africa, the African continent. So if that struck fear in the heart of this Andrew Lester, and he was able to execute this attack on this child, under the guise of stand your ground laws. And I think it's time that those laws be re-examined.
To what end, though? Right? Like, well, stand your ground on its face, the term, should be interpreted a lot different than
ready, fire, aim.
Well, then let's talk about Trayvon.
Yeah, let's talk, because that's where this verse came.
The first time I ever heard
about this.
Stand exactly. Your ground.
Yep.
A man stalked and murdered him,
mm-hmm.
and got off on the basis of standing his ground.
Sure.
In this case, weaponizing your fear of melanated skin gets you off on the idea that maybe you thought this young man was there to do you harm.
Mm-hmm.
And you also betting on that second shot doing its job. Because then we don't have to have a nuanced conversation. There's no other witnesses. There's you and the deceased who cannot provide his account of what happened.
I love that you said that, weaponizing your fear, because I think that's exactly what you were describing in your story, Marshawn, because these officers breaking your door, kicking in your door, and then grabbing you in the, I'm guessing, like an atrium or entrance of your home, and being able to attack you like this, there's that degree of protection, the qualified immunity, so forth and so on, where if police brutality or overreach or whatever takes place, they often say, well, it was based on a fear for myself, or fear, whatever the case is. And so weaponizing the fear, and obviously you're a Black man, Ralph Jarl was a Black child, and that's really the only way that I can see that existing as a narrative, not a truth, but a narrative in the minds of those who would cause harm to Black bodies.
So just a quick question. The Andrew guy, he didn't get arrested on the scene because it was a stand your ground law in effect?
Yeah, so we'll jump right there. I'm glad you brought that up. So what happened initially, the shooter Andrew Lester was taken into police headquarters briefly to provide a statement, but was released shortly after without being charged. How about that? Now, real quick, I want to interject something here. You're listening to my voice. You know that there is a Black child who's 16 years old and a white man who was in his 80s, right? This white man shot this Black child through the door. I want you to do me the favor that I often ask for on the show. I want you to change a couple of these pieces around. Let's make the 16-year-old child a white child. And let's make Andrew Lester
Black.
Now let that play out in your head. Now, the police show up. What happens to Andrew Lester? Does he go into police headquarters briefly to provide a statement and release shortly after without being charged? Does it happen that way?
No, I think he would have got arrested right on the spot.
Or worse. I know Q. For those that can't see,
I just got a quick question, Ram.
Yeah, what's up?
Do you believe that they charged him because they felt the story was going too viral?
I'm glad you brought that up. Let me read. All right. So Andrew Lester was able to go home and clean up any evidence as pressure mounted for police to charge him with a crime.
Can you imagine Black Andrew Lester not being shot when the police arrive, not being charged with a crime or arrested, allowed to go into police headquarters, give his statement, and then go home and clean up any potential evidence?
Now,
especially because in his statement, yes, I shot him. Okay, thanks for your statement, sir. Have a good one. Not let us keep you in custody while maybe a crime scene investigator goes to see if the story checks out, since we don't have any other witnesses. No, you're fine, man. Go home and get your affairs together so we can make sure you're going to be okay. I mean, all you did was shoot a Black kid.
Right.
And, you know, we all know that's not a big deal, right?
Man, you be keeping it real. This is so sad, but you're telling the truth.
Just one thing. Do you think that if Andrew was black, that he would have got to do the peaceful surrender, because he got to have his last meal, then go turn himself in after the charges got brought against him.
You know what? I think you're touching on something that is a theme around here. And I will summarize the criminal justice system in the United States of America treats you very different if you are white and guilty than if you are black and innocent. It'll treat you worse if you're black and innocent than if you're white and guilty.
Now, come on, Ramses. You know conversations like this are intellectually beneath us, and you need to be a higher thinker, because of course things aren't that simple. They don't just treat you worse because you're black and innocent and better
for those that know,
white and guilty. They would never.
Q is obviously being facetious here. You can't see his face, but but yeah, this is a theme that and this is a big part of why the show exists in the first place, is that you know, you weren't around, obviously, but in 2020 when George Floyd was murdered, and we all saw him be murdered, and we saw that there was initially no accountability, the idea that in spaces where this show is broadcast, in particular hip hop stations, there were people who were profiting from the culture, there were people who were chronicling a narrative of what it means to be black in this country, and there was a visibly absent moment that was necessary, a moment of clarity where we talked about indeed the fullness of the black experience in this country. We need to talk about systemic oppression. We need to talk about systemic injustice. We need to talk about white supremacy, white supremacist institutions. We need to talk about economic inequality. We need to talk about housing. We need to talk about healthcare outcomes. We need to talk about the criminal justice system, among other things. And so, to your point, that is indeed the reason the show exists. So I appreciate you bringing that up. I want to read a little bit more because, believe it or not, it gets deeper. Charges of first-degree assault and armed criminal action came 2 days later. Okay, I want to stop here. Okay, so 2 days later, he's charged, again, because of mounting public pressure, as you mentioned, Marshawn. And he's charged with first-degree assault, armed criminal action. That's not attempted murder. You said he got shot in the head, right?
First shot.
And then he got shot again?
And then he shot him again.
Okay, so that sounds to me like attempted murder. They didn't even charge him with that, right?
It probably felt to him like successful murder.
Yeah, probably in that moment.
Sounds like capital murder.
Mm. Well, we're grateful that Ralph is recovering, for those that haven't followed the story. And we're grateful that you're recovering too, Marshawn, because we don't often get stories like this. A lot of times we end up talking about people and they can't say anything. So we're really appreciative. I want to make sure that that's established. We're grateful that you could come to the studio and tell your story.
Yes.
But yeah, you know, when you said that they hit you with a bunch of charges that they ultimately had to drop, and let's be honest, they forced you to take a plea deal to get out of solitary confinement so you can go back home and recover. Q calls that trumped up charges, right? We're talking about the same criminal justice system. Q, I'm going to ask you a question. Does first degree assault and armed criminal action sound like a fair charge for what happened here with Andrew Lester shooting Ralph Jarl in the head? Is that trumped up charges?
It's barely
anything.
Anything.
Yes.
It's a slap on the wrist. Let's charge him with something.
So that the people
won't. Right.
Okay. Okay. Does it sound like there's two different criminal justice systems operating in the United States? Does it sound like...
I've said now many times on this show, the conversation that you are attempting to have is intellectually beneath us. I need you to subscribe to a higher vein of thinking and remove this very, very elementary idea that racism is always prevalent in these stories.
You know what's funny is that there are people who actually feel that way.
I don't understand why you have to interject race into everything.
Well, as I mentioned, I'm not talking to you, of course. I'm talking to people that would have that weird argument against, you know, what we're saying here. Again, we've talked about on this show housing discrimination. It's a real thing. You don't have to listen to the show to find that out. You can research it yourself. We've talked about attacks on history, critical race theory, and educating people so that we have a more empathetic and understanding society and way to relate to each other. We've talked about the legacy of redlining and the economic inequality that Black people are enduring in this country right now. We've talked about the failed war on drugs and how drugs, once upon a time, were criminalized. And Black people were put in jail, disproportionate sentences, and indeed, drugs were pushed into Black communities, and everyone was just like, just say no. And then when the tables turn and it's fentanyl, now all of a sudden it's a health problem. It's not a criminal issue.
Well, that's not because it's fentanyl.
Hang on. It's because it's white people. I know. But let me finish. We're talking about environmental racism, right? For those that don't know what environmental racism is, please look it up. I would love to tell you more about it. We've talked about it on the show, but if you don't know, please look up what environmental racism is. Find out that Black communities are polluted at a higher rate than white communities because people in power, people that are elected at local governments who themselves are hateful. I see you, Oklahoma. I see you, North Carolina. And local governments have no problem polluting Black and brown communities. Okay? We're talking about the fiscal implications of the unequal disbursement of the GI Bill in this country. We're talking about policing. We're talking about judicial sentencing. We're talking about the legacy of Black codes. We're talking about the legacy of the New Deal being unevenly distributed to America's population. White people benefited vastly more than Black people. This is what we're talking about.
And that's
to people that might say what you were saying earlier, real quick.
That's not unique to the New Deal.
And many others. Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's probably true for everything.
Call it
whatever you want.
Yes, absolutely. But to folks who might say that an argument is intellectually beneath me, I have all those and so many more. We haven't even talked about healthcare outcomes and how racism is cooked into the medical books, you know, that indoctrination and how a lot of those experiments that white people benefit from were performed on Black slaves and the legacy of that and how doctors think that we take in more oxygen and have thicker skin and feel less pain. And real healthcare outcomes that cause us to die more exist in the world, right? So welcome to Civic Cypher, everybody.
All I'm saying, Ramses, is I don't understand, even with all that data, statistics, and facts, why you guys feel the need to always interject the idea of race into every discussion you have. I don't understand.
To people who might say that, again, he was being funny, but to people who might say that to me,
not funny.
People who might say that to me,
he was not being funny.
Well,
he was being annoyed.
That's a better way to say it.
Because these are the exact things that people say to us.
Yes,
in person, in direct messages, on our lives, on our Facebook, and our comments, that we are somehow looking for the racism in all these stories, as if it's not blatant.
It's super there, super obvious.
This is not hidden, covert stuff we're talking about. This is in your face, overt, proud.
It's written into the laws. It's written into the bylaws. You can see it. The government documents. This isn't guessing. This isn't even data for people that feel like data and alternative facts and all that sort of fake news stuff. You can look at the laws themselves and trace indeed the legacy of those laws. Speaking of laws, let's get back to this criminal, quote unquote, Andrew Lester, that shot this child in the head and then shot him again.
In the head and in the shoulder, I believe.
So guess what happened after he was hit with those baby charges? He was able to post a $200,000 bond and is now free again. That means he came up with $20,000. And right now, as of this recording, he's walking around Kansas City, free as a bird. He can fight his case.
Disgustingly, I'm sure, being celebrated by some of his.
Exactly. Now, hold on a second. Did you have to take a plea deal, Marshawn?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. That's what I wanted to know. Did you hurt anybody?
No.
Did they hurt you?
No. Oh, they did.
They hurt you. Yes. I remember the story. So. Yes, they did. Okay. I just want to make sure that we are all subscribed to the same reality here and that these things are happening. And I'm not in a dream world half the time or whatever. This is the same shared experience for all of us. I do want to say this while we have a few seconds left. Ralph, Jarl, he's at home now and he's healing. But a couple of questions that I want folks to ponder, because again, we're dealing with living in the aftermath of anti-Black violence. What will his future be like? And Marshawn, these are questions that we would ask.
PTSD.
Sure, sure. Trauma, community trauma, because it doesn't just affect you. You mentioned it affects your kids. I'm sure Ralph is going to have this trauma with him for a long time. What does this teach the country about what's okay and what's not okay and to who? Why were the charges so light? If why didn't they charge him with assaulting a minor even, you know? And as always, keep thinking, what if Ralph was white and Andrew Lester was Black? And now it's time for the Way Black History Fact. Today's Way Black History Fact is sponsored by Underground Beach Club. From the streets to the beach, for the finest in beachwear, visit undergroundbeachclub.com. Today we are reading from thehockeywriters.com. I will begin. In January 2020, Canada Post released a special stamp and first day cover featuring what is undoubtedly hockey's greatest secret. The stamp features teams and artwork of players from the Colored Hockey League. Between 1895 and the early 1930s, all-Black ice hockey teams in the Maritimes thrilled mixed audiences and news reporters alike as they challenged each other to exciting matches and vied for the ultimate prize, the Colored Hockey Championship. Created as a means of drawing more men to church and strengthening their religious path, all-Black hockey also served to dispel myths about Black people's abilities. With their fast-paced physical games and down to the ice style of goaltending, the players made real contributions to the game. While winning on the ice was a moment to celebrate, the greater triumph was the pride experienced by Black communities across the region. Hockey fans may know of the Montreal Wanderers, the Ottawa Silver Seven, the Winnipeg Victorias, and the Vancouver Millionaires, as well as the Seattle Metropolitans, and some of the teams from the early years of the Stanley Cup. But very few have ever heard of the Africville Seasides, the Halifax Eurekas, and the Halifax Stanley, who were the original teams that formed Canada's first organized hockey league, the Colored Hockey League. More than a century ago, hockey played a huge role in Canadian Black culture on the East Coast. The Black leaders of the day recognized it, and they used hockey as a vehicle for advancement. The Colored Hockey League has perhaps the most intriguing history of any sports league in North American history. It was formed in 1895, predating the formation of the NHL by more than 20 years. The league also predates the Negro Baseball League in the United States. What makes it interesting is that the league was actually formed by the Baptist Church. The mandate of the league was to use hockey as a way of advancing young Black men to a level equal to their white brethren through a game that would instill the qualities of leadership, community, organization, pride, teamwork, and determination. Henry Sylvester Williams and brother James Borden were two of the visionaries who guided the formation of the league. They were both churchmen who saw the social and political importance of using hockey to encourage advancement of Black men. They also saw it as a way to attract young men and families to churches that were suffering from stagnating attendance. Williams's Cornwallis Baptist Church in Halifax would form two teams, the Halifax Stanley and the Halifax Eurekas. Across the harbor, Borden would form the Dartmouth Jubilees from his Lake Baptist Church. The league was operated by the church, making it unique in North American history. The official rule book was the Bible. First ever colored hockey league game was played on February 27, 1895 at the Dartmouth Curling Rink, and the Eurekas and Jubilees skated to a 1-1 tie. The league received press and coverage from the Acadian Recorder, which was one of three Halifax newspapers of the day, and it was Baptist owned. The Recorder reported that the game featured a much more physical style of play than the more gentlemanly white teams would play, as players would partake in body checking and cross counters, short punches. The Recorder also reported that through the first season, ladies would turn out in full force for the games, cheering loudly. There were no nets, and curling stones were used as posts. The star of the Jubilees was their goalie, Henry Braces Franklin. And an ice cutter by trade, Franklin revolutionized his position as he was the first goalie who reportedly went down on the ice to make saves in the game's history. Franklin's butterfly style was eventually made popular by goalies like Glenn Hall and Patrick Roy. Another innovation of the Colored Hockey League was the slap shot. It may have been made famous by Bernie Boom Boom Geffroon and Bobby Hull, but it was Colored Hockey League star Eddie Martin who invented it. The Stanley would win the first championship, while the Eurekas would win the next five. The season was short, usually running from late January to early March, as artificial ice was not available in the Maritimes. The league also had to take whatever ice times were available, as they had to work around the schedules of the white teams and leagues. Regardless, attendance was strong. Some playoffs and championship games drew more than 1,000 spectators. The caliber of play was considered by many to be on par with the scene in the best white leagues. Unfortunately, as the league was thriving, politics and racism became an obstacle. Expanded rail service onto the port of Halifax led to the annexation of land from many families in Africville, the black community in Halifax. A five-year legal battle ensued, and many rink owners refused to rent ice time to the league or any of its teams. Under pressure from municipal and provincial officials, the local newspaper stopped covering the league. There are no newspaper accounts of any colored hockey league play from 1911 to 1920. But in 1921, the league resurfaced in the public eye. Three teams, the Victorias, the Seasides, and the Halifax All-Stars, formed a three-league team. The league was not as strong, as it was in its prime. In the 1930s, the league would fade away. Many black families left the economical repression they suffered in Nova Scotia for the greener pastures of Boston. Although new teams like the Africville Brown Bombers, Halifax Diamonds, and Halifax Wizards, new Glasgow Speed Boys, and Truro Sheiks would emerge, the league was gone and forgotten by the time World War II had begun. There's very little history on this hockey league, which is why Canada's post 2020 Colored Hockey League stamp series is so significant. In 2004, hockey researchers Daryl George Frosty researched a book entitled Black Ice, The Lost History of the Colored Hockey League in the Maritimes, 1895 to 1925. The Hockey Hall of Fame also has an exhibit that includes information on the Colored Hockey League, the changing face of hockey, diversity in our game. Is a permanent exhibit that brings to light the challenges faced by marginalized people across North America in their struggle for social equity and acceptance in the great game of hockey. The display pays homage to the pioneers who confronted discrimination from the hockey world through their perseverance, talent, and courage. They have enriched the cultural landscape of hockey and established a tangible forum in which to fight prejudices still faced by many, both in hockey and in life. To date, there have been nearly 100 black players to lace up and play in the NHL. Some, like O'Ree, have been pioneers. Some, like Grant Fuhr, have been Stanley Cup champions. Some, like Jerome Iginla, have become superstars. They have all become household names to hockey fans. Obviously, I'm not. Sorry, but this is a cool story. And it's time for players and teams in the Colored Hockey League to become widely known in the hockey world as well. Again, I want to shout out thehockeywriters.com for providing us with the source material for that. Something that I didn't know. Normally, I throw all the sports stuff to Q because he knows a little bit about that, but I didn't know if hockey would be something that he would know any more about than me. But I still think it's cool because obviously we need to know that. I wouldn't have known it otherwise.
Yeah, it's interesting no matter what type of history we're talking about, be it sports, be it climate, be it eco, be it community, be it whatever, there's humps of racism. Mm-hmm. Without fail.
Everywhere.
Every time.
Yeah.
Not interjected by us, actually in the history.
Yeah. Yeah. And
Ramses used to remind our audience that Google was free.
It is.
I'll do it on his behalf today.
Appreciate that, Q. But that's going to do it for us here on Civic Cypher. So once again, thank you for tuning in. And I'm your host, Ramses Ja.
And I am still Q Ward.
A big shout out to our guest, Marshawn Neely. Thank you again, brother.
All right. Thank you. Yeah. Just want to give you guys your flowers, man, if no one else does.
No, we appreciate it, man. We appreciate it. We're trying to do something here. And if you want to support us on our way, check us out on social media. I'm at Ramses Ja.
I am Q Ward.
Go ahead and drop your social media.
Oh, I still got to make one.
Okay. Well, shoot. Marshawn Neely M-A-R-S-H-U-N for folks that want to follow that story as well. And hit the website, civiccypher.com, make a donation. Follow us on social media at Civic Cypher. You can download this and any previous episode as well. And of course, subscribe to our YouTube. We're building something special there, and we need you to be a part of that. That's Civic Cypher on YouTube, CIVICCIPHER. And until next week, y'all.
Peace.
Hey, yo, we handle it. These brothers are fabulous. Yeah. Dilated, showing you where rhyme travel is. Worlds are spit tune from sunlight to moon. Bussing off stage like gunfight saloons. Pull my mic back, you like that? Journalists, we're journalists too. We can strike back. Hardcore reporters with orders from headquarters. Behind enemy lines, sidestepping the borders. With press passes, we bring it to you as it happens. The streets love my crew for music and rapping. Street commander slash beat expander. Here to fight the slander with the proper propaganda. What's happening? You got a question, then ask it. The news is just a TV show, get past it. And this from a quiet wartime journalist. Headlines, wake up, refuse and resist. Like this.
There. This is Jello Biafra. If you're tired of the OCA, Walt Disney, Westinghouse, General Electric, and police departments telling you what you should listen to, stay tuned in to KBOO Portland, listener-sponsored non-commercial community radio, 90.7 on your FM dial unless your FM was made in America.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30.